This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Over the past few years, corporations wanting to stage manage an announcement.
Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to the call.
Have turned to the corporate conference call. This is where reporters can dial in, grab some quotes, and write a story. And normally, they are pretty boring. But anyone listening to this call, this is a call convened by Facebook in 2014.
Joining me on the call today are Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook.
Anyone listening heard a pretty amazing prediction.
Thanks, Deborah, and thanks everyone for joining us today.
A prediction about the future of screens.
I'm excited to announce that Facebook has reached an agreement to acquire Oculus VR, the leader in virtual reality technology.
So this is Mark Zuckerberg on this conference call with reporters announcing that Facebook had bought for $2 billion, a company that makes virtual reality headsets. Now, at this point, a lot of Facebook investors were questioning that acquisition. They were asking questions like, isn't virtual reality that thing that was supposed to happen back in the 80s that never took off? And so Zuckerberg, on this call, was trying to justify to those investors why his company just spent $2 billion on a technology most people have never seen. And this is what he said.
The history of our industry is that every 10 or 15 years, there's a new major computing platform, whether it's the PC, the web, or now mobile. History suggests that there will be more platforms to come, and that whoever builds and defines these will not only shape all of the experiences that our industry builds, but also benefit financially and strategically.
Okay, just a pause and translate that. In the past, he's saying, anyone able to get in on the ground floor of new technology platforms like the PC or the internet or mobile devices changed the way we live and made their investors a boatload of money. Okay, let's keep listening.
Mobile is the platform of today, and now we're starting to also get ready for the platforms of tomorrow. To me, by far the most exciting future platform is around vision, or modifying what you see to create augmented and immersive experiences. I believe Oculus can be one of the platforms of this future.
So basically, this is Mark Zuckerberg in March 2014 predicting that virtual reality goggles are the next smartphone, the next internet, the next thing that's going to transform our lives. And quietly, over the past few years, a lot of other tech companies, Microsoft, Google, Sony, they've also been betting a lot of money on that same idea.
People are looking at this technology, I think, as some people think it's a novelty, some people think it's a video game. People are beginning to see it as a possible next step to cinema. I think what we're ultimately talking about is an alternate version of human consciousness.
This is Chris Milk. He's a filmmaker whose new company, Verse, makes virtual reality films. These are films designed to be watched using those virtual reality goggles. And Chris has already put out a few early versions of those films, which you can watch.
Turn.
Turn what?
Turn your body.
Oh!
On a simple smartphone app.
Oh, look at that.
We showed some of those films.
Oh, that's pretty f***ing cool.
To people around the NPR office.
Look up, look up. Tilt it up.
Oh. That's cool.
This is neat.
Wow.
Whoa, where did you guys get this?
Now, it's not what they're looking at that's important. It's
how
they're seeing it.
What is this?
Because the image you see changes.
This is so cool.
Depending on the direction you point the phone.
It's totally convincing.
And it starts to feel as if you're not just watching the screen.
Whoa.
You're actually inside it.
The incredible thing about the technology is that you feel like you're actually present in another place with other people. It's different from anything I've ever experienced in my life, and many people who try it also say the same thing.
As we're going to hear on this episode, the technology behind our screens is moving really fast. So fast, in fact, that we sometimes spend more time imagining how our screens will change in the future than really understanding how our screens are changing us right now.
You are always there.
And it keeps us there.
Even if you're not actually there.
Because it's so good at distracting us.
You can click a button and get a dopamine hit and get some information.
Something is blinking, pay attention.
But it's not satisfying information most of the time.
Yeah, I try to be healthy about it. I don't want it to dictate my life.
But I think if things continue to go the way that they're going, it's just going to get too much for people.
You know, I spend a lot of time in airports and I look around and everybody, literally to a person, is glued to their...
There's your phone, right now.
There it is, even as
right now.
You can hear it, I'm buzzing.
I can
buzzing.
Hear it, it's buzzing right now. Today on the show, Screen Time. Part one of a two-part TED Radio Hour looking at this moment in history when we're starting to interact with our screens almost as much or sometimes even more than we do with other humans. Next week, we're going to go inside the screen, a place where a whole other version of you lives, like a digital doppelganger, which may be more real than the real you. But this week, we're staying mainly outside the screen, and we're going to start to ask what all this screen interaction is doing to us, and how we're living more and more of our lives through it.
Imagine enjoying a courtside seat at a game, studying in a classroom of students and teachers all over the world, consulting with a doctor face-to-face, or going shopping in a virtual store where you can touch and explore the products you're interested in, just by putting on goggles in your own home. This is really a new social platform.
Often we talk about, are we creating our eventual dystopian future? And if that is the case, and you are listening to this in the future,
I'm really sorry.
I'm really sorry about that.
We'll hear more from Chris Milk later on about how virtual reality technology could change how we experience the world around us. But first, what everyday screen technology is changing about us right now. Just before we start, make sure your phone is off, not on silent.
Sounds good. So then you can't pick up all the buzzes, and I can't get distracted by my own screen while talking about screens.
Yeah, exactly. This is Amber Case. She's an anthropologist. Actually, to be precise, and this sounds a little weird, but just bear with me, Amber is a cyborg anthropologist.
That's correct. There is a subfield of the anthropology of science, which is the anthropology of cyborgs. And it looks at the relation between humans and technology, how technology affects culture and how things change over time.
And how technology is such a big part of our lives now. Because Amber says, to a certain extent, we are all becoming cyborgs. She explained that idea from the TED stage.
You're not RoboCop and you're not Terminator, but you're cyborgs every time you look at a computer screen or use one of your cell phone devices. So what's a good definition for cyborg? Well, a traditional definition is an organism to which exogenous components have been added for the purpose of adapting to new environments. That came from a 1960 paper on space travel, because if you think about it, space is pretty awkward. People aren't supposed to be there. But humans are curious, and they like to add things to their bodies so that they can go to the Alps one day and then become a fish in the sea the next. So let's look at the concept of traditional anthropology. Somebody goes to another country, says, how fascinating these people are, how interesting their tools are, how curious their culture is. And then they write a paper and maybe a few other anthropologists read it and we think it's very exotic. Well, what's happening is that we've suddenly found a new species. I, as a cyborg anthropologist, have suddenly said, oh, wow, now suddenly we're a new form of Homo sapiens. And look at these fascinating cultures, and look at these curious rituals that everybody is doing around this technology. They're clicking on things and staring at screens.
In other words, our screens are just another tool in the long line of human inventions that have changed the way we live. So think of stone tools or bronze arrows or the knife. Those tools became so useful, they were almost like extensions of our physical selves, almost like another limb.
I mean, a hammer is really an extension of your fist. A knife is really an extension of your tooth. And you can actually make that device, so to speak, outside of yourself. And if it breaks, you can just make a new one. Whereas, say, if you're a saber-toothed tiger and your tooth breaks, you might not be able to eat something again, right? So having our devices outside of ourselves and being able to kind of switch them out depending on what we needed to do, makes us incredibly versatile creatures.
And not that long after we invented physical tools to extend what our bodies could do, humans came up with mental tools to extend what our brains could do.
So we were able to paint on the side of a cave wall, and then that stores mental information outside of ourselves, and that allows somebody else in the future to look at that and reabsorb the information back into their brain.
Yeah.
Then we had papyrus, we had scrolls, paper, the printing press, and allowed for us to have an increase in the ability to take information outside of ourselves and allow somebody to download it back into their brain. But now you have Facebook and Twitter and all of these different social networks, and so we're just information, information, information. But I think that the phones and a lot of these social interfaces are becoming so personal because it's not just a phone. It's kind of a mental exoskeleton. It's an external part of your brain.
I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, it isn't just a phone. I mean, through it, you have access to an infinite set of ideas.
Yeah, it's really a magic portal that allows you to go into another dimension of space and time.
Alert. Your FedEx package was delivered. Saturday, 2 p.m.
I mean, literally, you're going into different time zones.
Reminder.
With the click of a button.
Email John by 10 p.m. GMT.
And so you're getting these messages from these different places all the time.
Alert. Federal judge orders Kentucky.
And they're kind of chopping up your experience
Round
of
Los Angeles to New York
reality.
Reminder. Wednesday spin class. Alert.
In which you're living in many different kind of social time zones, the time zones of
Stephen Price favorited your tweet,
the apps on your phone,
and three others commented on your
the
photo.
People texting you,
time are we meeting for dinner? Happy birthday. Hey, have you left yet?
The people who've left you voicemail.
It's just Grammy. I just wanted to talk to you about something.
That you can't listen to because it's too noisy out.
Nothing important or anything.
You're on the side of the street and there's a truck driving by.
Hope I get to see you then.
I mean, really, it's a mobile desktop, and one of the problems is that it really demands all of your attention instead of lets you be human. Like, your primary task as a human should be being human, but when this device demands all of your attention, it can interrupt other primary tasks, for instance, driving or just walking down the street. I mean, we saw the video of the guy who was walking down the street texting and ran into a bear.
That is, like, right there, the clash of the human dual reality. The imagined reality and the objective reality, right there, on his iPhone and crashing into the bear.
Right, because walking down the street is often kind of a boring place, and so you can escape from it by going into a different type of place.
Yeah.
This virtual reality that we have in our pockets has become often more real, or at least attracting our attention more. So even though it makes you temporarily superhuman, it actually gets rid of a lot of the other sensory perception that you might need to rely on as an individual in society.
So if we've outsourced a part of our brain to the device in our pocket, now what? Cyborg anthropologist Amber Case returns in just a minute. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, Screen Time, you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, just a quick thanks to NatureBox.com. They're one of our sponsors who help keep this podcast going. NatureBox is on a mission to make smart, delicious snacking easy, from Asiago and cheddar cheese crisps to mini Belgian waffles. NatureBox delivers over 100 different types of snacks right to your door, and all NatureBox snacks are made with high-quality ingredients and no artificial junk. Visit NatureBox.com and get your first box now. Hey, before we get back to the show, I just wanted to ask if you could possibly share a story with us. We're doing something special for this two-part series, and we're hoping that you might want to tell us a story about a time when your digital life, the life that you live inside the screen, might have spilled over into your real one. So, like, maybe you met the person you love online, or maybe you got catfished, or maybe you did something horribly embarrassing in a YouTube video and it went viral, and you're listening to this from a remote fishing village in, like, the Northwest Territories of Canada because you lost your job and your friends and everybody wanted to get away from you. Or maybe not. But please do let us know. We hope to include some of them in next week's episode, part two of Screen Time. You can record a voice memo and send it to tedradiohour@npr.org. Or you can call us and leave a message. Our number is 202-216-9529. Thanks. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Our show today, Screen Time, Part 1. We're looking at how our interaction with screens is changing us. And we were just hearing from anthropologist Amber Case, who studies how our screens increasingly are extensions of ourselves.
And because of that, you have a second self.
Here's more from her TED Talk.
Whether you like it or not, you're starting to show up online and people are interacting with your second self when you're not there. And suddenly we have to start to maintain our second self. You have to present yourself in digital life in a similar way that you would in your analog life. So in the same way that you wake up, take a shower, and get dressed, you have to learn to do that for your digital self. And the problem is that a lot of people now, especially adolescents, have to go through two adolescencies. They have to go through their primary one that's already awkward, and then they have to go through their second self's adolescence. And that's even more awkward because there's an actual kind of history of what they've gone through online. And so what happens is when we bring all of that into the social space, we end up checking our phones all the time. So we have this sort of thing called ambient intimacy. It's not that we're always connected to everybody, but at any time we can connect to anyone we want. And so there are some psychological effects that happen with this. What I'm really worried about is that people aren't taking time for mental reflection anymore, and that they aren't slowing down and stopping being around all those people in the room all the time that are trying to compete for their attention. They're not just sitting there. And really, when you have no external input, that is the time when there's a creation of self. When you can try and figure out who you really are. And then once you do that, you can figure out how to present your second self in a legitimate way. Instead of just dealing with everything as it comes in and, oh, I have to do this, and I have to do this, and I have to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's also affecting, like, I lose my mind if I'm in a line and for some reason I don't have my smartphone with me. You know what I mean? Have you experienced that?
I experience that all the time. Now, the issue is that a lot of people are using their phone in a supermarket checkout line because as a human in an industrial society, they're put on pause. And the thing that reconnects them to some sort of humanity is to take out their phone. You see people using phones a lot in non-places, something that you don't have any relation or history or identity in. And the phone itself has more relation, history, and identity to you than an airport, for instance, or a highway. So you often find people using their phones in these kind of inhuman places in order to get back some of that humanity that's been put on pause.
So what do you do? I mean, how do you get away from all that?
I like to go on road trips because I like to go on road trips and bring paper maps and turn off my phone because I am forced to be with myself, forced to talk to the person next to me, and look outside. It feels really nice afterwards. Like when you're a kid and you have to experience real time. Like you feel like you're a little bit more real again.
Amber Case, she's a cyborg anthropologist. You can check out her full talk at TED.com. So if your screen or your device is like an extension of your mind, it's also a way to convey your emotions. You can write a Facebook post about a bad day, or you can put out an Instagram photo of a great day smiling. But the thing is, your screen can't really understand how you feel, at least not yet.
I think building machines and devices that can sense your emotions, I think with that type of technology, instead of people like emoting these social signals and then they disappear in cyberspace, we have an opportunity to capture them.
This is Rana El-Kalyubi. She's a computer scientist who spent the past few years at MIT's Media Lab. And the idea that our devices could be built to detect our emotions, it came to Rana when she moved from Cairo to Cambridge in the UK back in the late 1990s to work on her PhD.
That was the first time I was basically away from home.
Rana was in England by herself, thousands of miles away from anyone she knew.
And I was pretty lonely. There were a lot of these days.
And because she was in a new place where she didn't know anyone, Rana was actually spending most of her time with her laptop, which wasn't much of a friend at all.
I had absolutely no idea what my emotional state was, and I could be happy or I could be stressed or frustrated, and it would be completely oblivious.
So Rana is sitting there in England, and she's wondering, how could I fix this?
What if our devices could sense how we felt and reacted accordingly, just the way an emotionally intelligent friend would?
Today, more than 15 years after she first asked this question, Rana explained how she's getting closer to the answer. Here she is on the TED stage.
Those questions led me and my team to create technologies that can read and respond to our emotions. And our starting point was the human face. So our human face happens to be one of the most powerful channels that we all use to communicate social and emotional state. Everything from enjoyment, surprise, empathy, and curiosity. In emotion science, we call each facial muscle movement an action unit. So for example, action unit 12, it is a lip corner pull, which is the main component of a smile. Another example is action unit 4, it's the brow furrow. It's when you draw your eyebrows together and you create all these textures and wrinkles. We don't like them, but it's a strong indicator of a negative emotion. So we have about 45 of these action units, and they combine to express hundreds of emotions. Teaching a computer to read these facial emotions is hard because these action units, they can be fast, they're subtle, and they combine in many different ways.
So initially, Rana and her team fed tens of thousands of photos of people smiling or frowning into a computer program so it could learn all these tiny little micro-expressions. Today, they have 12 billion examples of those expressions, which makes the technology even better at detecting all the subtleties in our faces. And so what they've done is combine the program with a tiny camera, kind of like the one already built into your smartphone. And during her TED Talk, Rana brought up a volunteer. Her name is Chloe, and Rana gave Chloe an iPad to hold up in front of her face.
As you can see, the algorithm has essentially found Chloe's face, so it's this white bounding box.
And then it identifies the main feature points on your face.
Her eyebrows, her eyes, her mouth, and her nose.
And it starts tracking how these facial muscles move over time. So for example, when you smile.
And then as she smiles, this is a genuine smile. It's great. So you can see the green bar go up.
Your lip corners move upwards and outwards, and they create these wrinkles around your eyes and your cheeks.
Smile. Can you try like a subtle smile to see if the computer can recognize? It does recognize subtle smiles as well. We've worked really hard to make that happen.
And it identifies these things and it says, oh, okay, you're smiling here. And it maps it to an emotional state.
Once Rana and her team perfect this technology, she imagines all kinds of ways other scientists and engineers could build it into our lives. For example, you could send an email one day embedded with data about how you were feeling as you wrote it. Or what if your phone or your laptop or maybe even the mirror in your bathroom read your face every day?
And imagine if all these devices talk to each other and they can capture various aspects of your day and your emotions of the day. And we have a baseline for you, so we know what's your norm. And then we also know when you deviate from that norm. So your phone can say, hey, you know, I've noticed that you haven't laughed for the past 4 days. What's going on? Is there something I can do to help? You know, if it knows your humor profile, for example.
And then I realized, oh my God, 50 Cent has no idea what a grapefruit is.
Can find content that is really funny.
Stay hungry, stay foolish.
Or inspiring.
As you graduate to begin anew, I wish that for you.
And it can suggest 5 minutes of meditation.
Or dance music.
Or dance music.
Yeah.
Or that too. So it can do a lot of things once it understands what your patterns are and what your emotions are over time.
I think in 5 years down the line, all our devices are going to have an emotion chip, and we won't remember what it was like when we couldn't just frown at our device and our device would say, you didn't like that, did you? Imagine if your learning app sensed that you're confused and slowed down, or that you're bored, so it sped up, just like a great teacher would in a classroom. Emotion-enabled wearable glasses can help individuals who are visually impaired read the faces of others, and it can help individuals on the autism spectrum interpret emotion, something that they really struggle with. What if your wristwatch tracked your mood, or your car sensed that you're tired? Or perhaps your fridge knows that you're stressed, so it auto-locks to prevent you
from binge eating. I would like that, yeah. What if when I was in Cambridge, I had access to my real-time emotion stream and I could share that with my family back home in a very natural way, just like I would have if we were all in the same room together?
How do you imagine all this could, like, change us, right? Because, I mean, I don't know, part of this makes me a little uncomfortable.
So we're very social animals and social beings. And the only thing we're changing is this paradigm in which we interact with technology, right? We are becoming more and more digital. We're surrounded by a lot more highly connected, intelligent devices. And I don't think that that's going to change anytime soon. Like, I don't see my daughter suddenly stopping texting. Like, that's going to be very hard. So I think the solution is not to curb our use of technology, but instead embrace it and build empathy into that technology. Like, I think it's important that we learn as humans that our emotions continue to matter, even in a digital world.
That's Rana El-Kalyoubi. Her company is called Affectiva. You can check out her entire talk at TED.com. On the show today, part one of a two-parter we're calling Screen Time. This episode, we're looking at the way we interact with our screens and how those interactions might be changing us. So think about the human brain. From a very early age, our brain responds to and is shaped by what we see and what we hear. This idea has been studied by a lot of scientists, including this one.
My name is Dimitri Christakis. I'm a pediatrician and epidemiologist and a parent of two teenagers.
And a few years ago, Dimitri did a study on newborn babies, just a day old, and he played them music like this, Mozart. And then he would analyze their breathing.
What we've learned is that babies, even at one day of age, will have discernible changes in the respiratory rate and their breathing, depending on what they're hearing.
So a baby listening to this,
you actually will see that their breathing pattern is slow and steady.
So like, if you're listening to Mozart, it's like...
That's about right.
But in contrast, he says,
if you put on something that has a different, say, Stravinsky, with more minor chords, the breathing pattern became more irregular and slightly faster. And then the very interesting thing was, at the end of that segment of Stravinsky, we put Mozart back on. And then you see a return to the original breathing pattern.
They're like, ah, that's more like it.
Now, that isn't to say that one source of music or another is preferable to the baby.
Yeah.
But what we can say is that they are so attuned to their environment early on that they make such subtle distinctions, even on their very first day of life.
Now, the idea here is that the way our brains are stimulated matters, especially when we're young and our brains are being shaped by that stimulation. But for most kids, that stimulation is not Mozart. It's not Stravinsky. It's screen time, lots and lots of screen time. Here in the U.S., for example, the typical preschool child spends about 4.5 hours a day in front of the screen. And Dimitri has been researching what that means for those kids and for their future. Here's his TED Talk.
Now, we know from decades of research that too little stimulation early on is bad for brain development. But the question we've had in our lab for some time is, what about too much? Is it actually possible to overstimulate the developing brain, or more appropriately, to inappropriately stimulate the developing brain in ways that are actually not beneficial, but harmful? And this is important because we're technologizing childhood today in a way that's unprecedented. In 1970, the average age at which children began to watch television regularly was 4 years. And today, based on research that we've done, it's 4 months. It's not just how early they watch, but how much they watch. The typical child before the age of 5 is watching about 4.5 hours of TV a day. That represents as much as 40% of their waking hours.
And I mean, all that screen time presumably is cutting down on how often kids are interacting, you know, in the real world.
The simple truth is that we're all what they call digital immigrants. I mean, the incredible thing to me is our children who, if they were born 5 years ago, didn't know a world where an iPhone didn't exist. And they are digital natives. They don't know of a world that these things didn't exist in, and they're incredibly tethered to them.
I mean, they're kind of like guinea pigs because most of the way they communicate and see the world will happen through a screen.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, because I'm asked a lot by parents about the effects of all of these new technologies, what I have to share with them is the fact that science quite literally cannot keep up with the pace of technological advances. So we started studying the iPad and touchscreen media about 3 years ago. We were probably among the first in the country to do it. And it takes a long time to get funding for research, and that's increasingly difficult. And then you have to conduct the experiments themselves, and that takes time. And you have to analyze the data. And
I mean, so basically, we don't know.
We know some things. I mean, I don't want to be entirely nihilistic. We do know some things. But you're right. In many other ways, we're in the midst of a large, uncontrolled experiment on the next generation of children.
One of those things scientists do know is that not all screens are created equal. And not all content is either.
Hi, Odd.
Oh, hi, Brad. I'm fine. How are you?
Good, thanks. I brought my television neighbor to see what a restaurant was like.
Oh, I'm so glad. Can I show you a table?
Certainly.
I'm awfully busy today. One of the waitresses is ill.
I see.
So I'm sort of doing double duty.
Fred Rogers invented reality TV.
This is fine.
He's not credited with it. Actually, it's not reality, right? It's even slower paced than reality. The waitress says, "I'm awfully busy," but she doesn't seem the least bit hurried. Now, I want to contrast that with the Powerpuff Girls movie, the right mix of sugar and spice for a satisfying rush. I don't know how many of you have seen that, but here's a scene from that. Again, you can see a lot of rapid sequencing. In fact, this was the first movie that was ever rated PG for non-stop frenetic animated action. So you can see that there are very, very real differences in pacing.
Dimitri says we're just starting to understand how pacing in TV shows could affect the human brain. But not just by studying humans.
There are limits to the kinds of experiments that we can't even do ethically, which is one of the reasons we've started working with mice in the lab, if you can believe it, to try to develop models of media usage that can be studied more robustly.
You turn mice cages into TV lounges?
TV lounges, yeah, that's right. That's a very nice way of putting it.
What it looks like and sounds like to spend your entire mousy childhood watching a big screen TV. And what it could mean for us. It's coming up in just a minute. I'm Guy Raz. Stay with us. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
TED Radio Hour is supported by Trunk Club, a clothing service that matches guys with personal stylists who do all the work to find them the clothes they need. Here's Trunk Club's VP of Merchandise, Jason Smith, talking about their approach.
I get excited about helping guys discover clothes that fit and feel better than anything else in their wardrobes. My team and I are always searching for new brands that deliver on quality, style, and value across a variety of price points.
Trunk Club is not a subscription service, and you only pay for the clothes you keep. Visit trunkclub.com/NPR to get started. Support for TED Radio Hour also comes from Vonage. In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service. They made it better with voice over internet. Now Vonage is back to work transforming communications for businesses with cloud-based solutions that basically let you manage your entire phone system from your desktop and seamless mobility between all your devices so you never miss that important call, no matter where you are. Data charges may apply. You can see how your business can get the better it deserves by calling 1-800-5-VONAGE or going to vonage.com.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. On the show today, Screen Time, a look at how all the screens in our lives are changing us And just a minute ago, pediatrician and researcher Dimitri Christakis, who studies screen time in kids, was about to describe an experiment he did with mice. And these were young mice, about 10 days old, and for a month, what ends up being their entire childhood, Dimitri gives them free, unlimited TV.
By having them listen to the cartoon channel and have photorhythmically activated lights provide visual stimulation to go along with it.
And this is what it's like. Bright, multicolored, flashing lights. 6 hours a day. This sounds like torture.
It's interesting, when we look at their cortisol levels, there's no physiological signs that this is actually stressful to them.
Oh.
But it is overstimulating their senses in much the same way television and other screen media do for young children's brains.
What Dimitri's mouse studies revealed is that the more the mice watched TV, the harder it became for those mice to learn and to stay attentive. So, for example, they'd get confused by objects they'd actually seen before, objects they should have learned to recognize already. So when researchers followed up these mouse studies with similar studies in children, comparing kids who, say, watch a lot of Mr. Rogers with kids who watch a lot of Powerpuff Girls, you can probably guess where this is going. They found pretty similar patterns.
What you see is that educational programs like Mr. Rogers pose no increased risk of attentional problems. Entertainment programs like the Powerpuff Girls increase the chances by about 60%. And violent programming, which I didn't show you, increases it even by more than 100%. And violent programs are typically even more rapidly sequenced.
Do you find that your attention span has been affected since you've been a screen user?
I do think that my attentional capacity has become somewhat diminished. Of course, maybe that has as much to do with aging as anything else. But I worry much more about my children, that they are able to stay focused on a task. Many people believe that multitasking and fast-paced world is what we live in, and children might as well learn to adapt to it early on. And I don't think that that's true. I certainly don't want people, whether they're CEOs of companies in the future, presidents of industry, or even artists or writers, to not be able to stay focused on something.
Yeah. I remember when my younger son was two, and we had a PBS program on TV, it was Sesame Street, and he walked up to the TV, and he started swiping right. He just like took his finger across the TV. And he couldn't understand why it wasn't reacting to him. Because to him, like, a screen was this thing that you can just touch and make it do what you want it to do.
That really has been a game changer in the last 5 years, these interactive screens. And it has given those of us that have researched children and screens real pause. But, you know, the one thing that a child never says or never thinks if they're pre-verbal when they interact with the typical passive media is, "I did it." And even the best quality children's shows that tried to engage children, recognizing how important that was to their cognitive and social development, would ask rhetorical questions.
"It is a beautiful day in this neighborhood. Is it in yours? Have you ever been to a circus? You like to swing? Do you have any idea what might be in this bag?"
Now, as a kid, you could answer Mr. Rogers. You could talk back to him. But you could never affect what happened on the screen. And Dimitri says this is an area where modern screen technology, like touchscreens or kids' apps, could actually do something that Mr. Rogers couldn't. Because by interacting with those screens, kids can say, "I did it. I made that happen."
Any parent of any child who's had the experience of putting them in a high chair and, let's say, giving them something, either a toy or a piece of fruit or whatever, knows what that child is going to do. They're going to take it and drop it, much to their delight. And they'll be even more delighted when the parent comes and picks it up and puts it back, thus creating kind of an infinite feedback loop.
Yeah.
Children love the fact that they make something happen in the real world. So what do I think? I think that touch screens and particularly high-quality apps are very, very different than passive media. But the challenge is, it's not just not all screens are the same. Not all content on screens is the same.
Dimitri Christakis. He's a pediatrician and researcher at Seattle Children's Hospital. You can check out his talk at ted.npr.org. Most of what we've been hearing about so far is how all this technology is affecting us personally. But screens are also changing the way we think about really big, consequential things. When you think about war, how much of it is moving to screens?
The experience for a large number of the players, so to speak, in war is happening on screen.
It's the level, actually, and here comes power.
This is Peter Warren Singer. He wrote a best-selling book about this called Wired for War.
When you're talking about an airstrike in a place like Pakistan or the like,
I got a guy running, throwing a weapon. Part of that.
It involves multiple people in multiple locations.
He threw it off in the field. He's running back to his vehicle.
It's not the human eye that's typically seen it. They're seeing it through some kind of surveillance device.
He's at the vehicle. Roger.
That camera might be beaming back to folks in a command and control center.
All right, got auto range on it?
Yeah. To commanders who might be back in the United States.
I'm engaging. Yep, engage.
You as a general, you as a president, didn't used to be able to watch the battle live. Now you can do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's that iconic image of, like, the president and his national security cabinet sitting in the Situation Room watching that operation to eventually kill bin Laden. Like, they're watching that in real time through a screen.
The things that we once imagined only in science fiction, whether it's the internet itself, cyberspace, to drones, cyber warfare, to universal surveillance and observation, the inability to keep secrets. All of these things were imagined in science fiction and have become real. But things don't play out exactly the way that we planned.
So you just heard Peter mention drones. Long before most of us even knew what they were, before we heard about the U.S. military using them to bomb targets in Pakistan or Yemen, Peter was raising questions about how they're changing war back in 2009 in this TED Talk.
Something big is going on in war today, and maybe even the history of humanity itself. The U.S. military went into Iraq with a handful of drones in the air. We now have 5,300. One of the people that I recently met with was an Air Force three-star general, and he said, basically, where we're headed very soon is tens of thousands of robots operating in our conflicts. A robot's revolution is upon us. Another way of putting this is that mankind's 5,000-year-old monopoly on the fighting of war is breaking down in our very lifetime.
So, Peter, you gave this talk about 6 years ago, and obviously a lot of things have changed. Who else is fighting wars like this now?
So 82 different countries have drone programs today of some way, shape, or form. But one of the interesting challenges that maybe looms in the future is if we were in a conflict with a major state power, each of those sides would look at the dependence that the other has on these technologies, from communications to command and control to intelligence, you name it, and they would try and take that away. They would, in essence, notice our dependence on the screen and try and jam or block or warp everything from traffic lights to the engine rooms of Navy ships.
I wonder if like, for the people who are actually doing the killing, you know, from far away, like the drone pilots, I mean, you would think that war would be cleaner, you know, for them somehow.
But I would argue that it's not clean and easy on the operators, even if they're operating from afar. Drone operators or analysts who are watching this video, even though they're not physically there, we're still seeing them suffer from PTSD or burnout or the like. When you take life, that is a psychological toll. When you see horrible things, whether you see them up close or from afar, it can take a toll. Another part of the explanation may be the disconnect of making these kind of decisions, seeing these sorts of things, and then an hour later standing in line at the Burger King or getting in an argument with your wife about, you know, forgetting to pick up milk.
The future of war is also going to be a YouTube war.
They're still firing the 203s. These guys right here are firing.
There's several thousand video clips of combat footage from Iraq on YouTube right now. Now, this could be a good thing. It could be building connections between the home front and the war front as never before.
Okay, we're still taking fire from our western flank. It's been RPGs and small arms.
But inevitably, the ability to download these video clips gives you the ability to turn it into entertainment. This ability to watch more but experience less creates a wrinkle in the public's relationship with war. I think about this with a sports parallel. It's like the difference between watching an NBA game, a professional basketball game on TV, where the athletes are tiny figures on the screen, and being at that basketball game in person and realizing what someone 7 feet really does look like. But we have to remember, these are just the clips. They lose the context. They lose the humanity. War just becomes slam dunks and smart bombs.
You know, Peter, I mean, the thing that's interesting is, and I know this is not, you know, a new question that you've sort of thought about, but it is, to me, a big question, which is, when a country has a capacity to send an unmanned aircraft somewhere to attack something or a person and control that through a screen, it means that making that choice to do that is arguably somewhat easier because you're not risking your own people. You're not risking their lives.
It used to be that the barriers to war were high. You know, you had to build castles or aircraft carriers. Not anyone could do it. And they were also high in terms of the political decisions that it was required to take your nation into war, you know, Congress itself voting. What we're seeing now is a lowering of the barriers.
Yeah.
We can see this, for example, in the drone wars, so to speak, that we've been fighting in Pakistan and Yemen. We've carried out more than 500 airstrikes. These are operations that if we were talking about manned systems, we'd be treating very differently. These are operations that have never been formally voted on by Congress. So the barriers to war have been lowered both through the broader availability of the technologies of war, but also the way that we view war, or even more so, things that are war that we're not willing to call war.
Peter Warren Singer, he's got a new novel out that touches on a lot of this stuff. It's called Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. You can see his entire talk at TED.com. Okay, so all this episode, we've been talking about what's happening to us on the real-world side of our screens, like how we interact with them from the outside. But this is a two-parter. And next week, on our second episode about screen time, we're going to step inside the screen, and we're going to ask a lot more questions about what it means for our lives, more and more, to be lived there. So to end this first episode, someone to lead us in. Do you think it's conceivable that we're heading towards a future where most of our lives will be lived digitally?
It's certainly not my goal, although it might look like that sometimes.
Chris Milk, he's the guy who made those virtual reality films we showed around the office at the beginning of the show.
Wow.
Whoa.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
You remember all that, right? So Chris started his career making music videos for people like Arcade Fire and Kanye West. He did the video for this track. I gotta testify. But after doing this kind of work for a while, he was looking to try something different, something more meaningful. So Chris started to design these interactive video installations, these films that he would mount in art museums. And he started to notice something.
I would sit there all day just like watching it from a dark corner.
By it, he means this film he designed. And the way it worked was that a camera would project your shadow onto a bright white wall. But if you moved your arms, your shadow, your actual shadow, would grow wings.
And if you flap them, you actually start flying up into the air and off the screen.
And Chris would notice that people changed when the screen was more than just a frame on the wall.
What I saw was this very visceral human reaction. People would just lose themselves inside of it.
So this sparked an idea for him, but also a problem.
The problem was there's just no way to scale something like that.
Yeah.
I can fit 6 people in it at a time. I can build it in another museum simultaneously, and then I've got 12 people in it at a time. I want 1 million people in it at a time.
Chris started to think more and more about the limits of the screen and how film hasn't really changed all that much since he was a kid growing up in the 80s. Here's Chris's TED Talk.
So film, it's an incredible medium, but essentially it's the same now as it was then. It's a group of rectangles that are played in a sequence. And we've done incredible things with those rectangles. But I started thinking about, is there a way that I could use modern and developing technologies to tell stories in different ways and tell different kinds of stories that maybe I couldn't tell using the traditional tools of filmmaking that we've been using for 100 years? But then I started thinking about frames and what do they represent? And a frame is just a window. I mean, all the media that we watch, television, cinema, they're these windows into these other worlds. And I thought, well, great, I got you in a frame, but I don't want you in the frame. I don't want you in the window. I want you through the window. I want you on the other side in the world, inhabiting the world. So that leads me back to virtual reality.
Okay, so before we talk about Chris's specific role in virtual reality, here's what's going on in that world generally. This holiday season and early into next year, a bunch of companies like Sony and Microsoft, Google, HTC, and Oculus, that's the company now owned by Facebook, they will all release virtual reality headsets. Basically, it's a big pair of goggles with a 3D screen inside. And along with some hand controllers, you'll be able to play all kinds of video games in a completely new way. That's where most of the focus is, video games. But Chris Milk isn't interested in video games. He makes movies, and he wants to make movies designed to be watched using these new headsets. And that means changing everything about the way movies are made, starting with the cameras.
The current technology that we're working with, and most people are working with, is sort of a ball of cameras with a lot of lenses that look in a lot of different directions simultaneously. Then we go into a post-production process and we stitch all those different directions together so that we have one singular sphere where you can look in every direction.
Which means if, say, the Rolling Stones put one of those cameras on stage with them, you could put on a VR headset and be there with them too. And from your vantage point on stage, you could turn your head in any direction and you would see a different part of it.
And when that happens, you get this feeling of what's called presence.
Yeah.
The way the world moves around you as your physical body moves through it is different than the way that you see a movie or you see a television show, which is this thing that's a rectangle and it's on a wall. But virtual reality actually mirrors the way that you see the world in real life.
So in Chris Milk's TED Talk, he describes how the better this technology gets at making you feel like you're really there, the more powerful and emotional these films will become. And one of those films is already pretty powerful. It's an 8-minute movie Chris described on the TED stage.
So this film is called Clouds Over Sidra, and it was made in conjunction with our virtual reality company called Verse and the United Nations and a co-collaborator named Gabo Aroro. And we went to a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan and shot the story of a 12-year-old girl there named Sidra. And her family fled Syria through the desert into Jordan, and she's been living in this camp for the last year and a half.
My name is Sidra. I am 12 years old. I am in the 5th grade. I am from Syria.
So, Chris, in this clip, we should explain that if you watch this in a VR headset, you're basically seeing this girl. She's right in front of you. She's talking to you. She's like sitting on a rug on the floor of in this dusty, hot building in this refugee camp.
Yeah, and the thing that happens in virtual reality that does not happen in a rectangle on your wall is you find yourself in the same room as this girl. When you look down, you're sitting on the same earth that she's sitting on.
I have a big family, 3 brothers. One is a baby. He cries a lot.
And something changes when that happens. And I can't tell you from a biological level or a cognitive level what that exactly is, but something definitely changes.
I like cloudy days. I feel like I am under a cover.
In this film, you can watch Sidra's friends walking right past you on their way to a temporary school. And when you look at them, they look back at you and smile and wave. Seeing this film in a virtual reality headset is so powerful because it's as if you are there. And Chris knows it. He's already shown the film at places like the World Economic Forum in Davos to some of the world's most powerful people. And when they watch it, he's seen tears literally stream down their faces as they experience that refugee camp.
We're working with the United Nations right now to shoot a whole series of these films. We just finished shooting a story in Liberia, and now we're going to shoot a story in India. And we're taking these films and we're showing them at the United Nations to people that work there and people that are visiting there. And we're showing them to the people that can actually change the lives of the people inside of the films. And that's where I think we just start to scratch the surface of the true power of virtual reality. It's not a video game peripheral. It connects humans to other humans in a profound way that I've never seen before in any other form of media. And it can change people's perception of each other.
I mean, it is all those things, right? Like, it is so exciting, and it's also so terrifying because you can imagine that it can change the truth. I mean, people's perceptions can be so affected and moved by an experience in this world that seems so real that it becomes real, right? Like, you can imagine somebody could take this technology and create what seems real, a real version of an idea, and convince minds, change minds, and actually create real hatred.
Yeah, you can use film, and you can use radio, and you can use literature to change minds for the purpose of evil, and you will be able to do it in virtual reality as well. I mean, you can't, let me turn it back on you. Would you say that we shouldn't have literature or we shouldn't have cinema because it can be used for those sort of purposes?
No, and of course not, right? No, of course not. That's a thing. It's like, you can't really foolproof this stuff. You can't make it impossible for evil people to use. It's just not,
you can't.
Right?
No, you can't.
Yeah.
So what I'd say, though, my hope would be that allowing people to have experiences that are impossible in the physical world can be an enlightening, life-changing, transformative experience. So I was in Sicily last week, and we're in this little village in this town square, and there was an elderly Italian couple there, and I had a headset in my backpack, and we asked them if they wanted to try it. They were friendly and smiling and talking to us. We asked them if they wanted to try it, and the man tried it on and came out on the other side with his eyes wide open, and in his broken English, he said that there is lots of very bad things in the world, but this was a good thing, and I hope he's right.
That's Chris Milk. You can download his company's app, Verse, it's VRSE, to see some of the films we talked about with or without a virtual reality headset. Now that we've stepped inside the screen, join us next week as we ask what it means for our lives, increasingly, to be lived there.
I predict that years from now, we'll regard taking away your access to virtual worlds as completely inappropriate.
What does this really mean? Are we going to be creatures that are going to live differently, breathe differently, love differently?
We're creating hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of pieces of content that are going to live online long after we're gone.
The way we are defined on the internet, on Google, has become more important than who we actually are as people.
That's next week on the show. Don't miss it.
Person go to shows and raise a lighter app. But if you're on my concert, please don't ever try that crap. The future might defeat me. The internet can eat me. It really tastes like chicken when I bite the hand that feeds me. And it's tragic that we yawn. We got every gadget, but don't care, there's magic in our palm.
When the sun burns out, we'll light the world with tiny glowing screens.
Thanks for listening to part one of Screen Time. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Daniel Shukin and Sharif Youssef. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. You can write to us by going to ted.npr.org and scrolling down to the button that says Contact Us. Let us know what you think. You can also follow us at either at Guy Raz or at TED Radio Hour. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, if you're still listening, you know, a lot of people ask me what podcasts I listen to, and I listen to a lot, and one of my favorites is NPR's Planet Money. It's full of super fun, insightful stories that explain all kinds of things about the world. You don't even have to care about finance or economics to love it. It's a great show, and you can find it right now at npr.org/podcasts or on the NPR One app.